Welcome to the season two finale of Blazing Trails. I'm Sabrina Barakzai, social and content marketer for Salesforce Strategic Events. Thank you so much for joining us on this season of Blazing Trails. We've shared stories about motivation, AI, authentic leadership, art, activism, and so much more. On today's season finale, we're excited to bring you a special episode dedicated to compassion in action. Respect, decency, compassion, and taking care of yourself. All of these factors are critical in how we interact in our organizations and workplaces. There are those who give, those who take, and those who fall somewhere in between. Where do you stand? How can we understand how compassion works from an organization? How can we work to find purpose and meaning in the everyday? When we look back and see the mistakes and failures that we face, how can we employ self-compassion? Adam Grant is a professor at the Wharton School of Business and a New York Times best-selling author. Last year at Dreamforce, he joined us to talk about compassion, feedback, and his background as an organizational psychologist. Today, we'll hear some amazing, funny, and insightful stories of his background and insights on compassion. Take a listen.
Good morning, everyone. I want to take you back about 15 years. I was working my first real job in advertising, and I had hired this guy who I thought was going to be a creative genius. And then he decided not to do any work, and he fell way behind on a major deadline. And I was watching this happen, and I had a choice to make. Do I speak up, or do I stay silent? And I know my whole life I've been the person who stayed silent. In elementary school, I remember getting called to the principal's office. I got there, I found out I was not in trouble, and I still cried. After that traumatic experience, I not only followed all the rules, I made a list of rules that didn't exist yet, and I followed those too, just in case one day somebody created them. And I was just terrified of getting in trouble, but I felt like in this situation, I had to act. So I looked around the organization, and I found the person who I knew would have my back. It was my boss's boss. She had nominated me for an award once. She would stop by my desk every week to talk about Survivor, which meant I had to watch Survivor. And I marched into her office and I said, look, this is a terrible injustice. Nobody should ever be treated this way. But I'm also worried this guy is gonna quit. And if you think we're behind on a deadline now, just wait until he marches out the door. Whew. Deep breath, nothing bad happened. Except suddenly my boss's boss is dragging me down the hallway and shoving me into a dark room. The lights go on, I'm totally disoriented because I'm somewhere I've never been in my entire life. Standing smack in the center of the women's bathroom. Turns out that's the only room on our floor with no windows, and my boss's boss tells me that if I ever speak out out of turn again, I'm gonna be fired. So I made a few decisions after that experience. The first one was that I was never gonna have a real job where someone could fire me. And this was the draw of university tenure, clearly. The second decision was that I was gonna go and become an organizational psychologist. And I was gonna study how we could create organizations where people were treated with real respect and decency and compassion. And that's a lot of what I've been trying to do over the past decade and a half. And then the third goal was to never again enter a women's bathroom. Check. So I went off to graduate school and I started studying the dynamics of helping others. And I found really early on that there were three different mindsets that people brought in their interactions. There were givers who constantly asked, what can I do for you? There were takers who were asking, what could you do for me? And most of us were right in the middle of that spectrum as matchers, saying, look, I want to play it safe. I'll do something for you if you do something for me. And it was very clear that nobody wants to work with takers, and that if we could build organizations of givers, that we would end up having more compassion, but also more productivity, because givers are willing to do all sorts of things that are not in their job description, but critical to the success of their teams and their organizations. And so I really wanted to understand, how do we build cultures where we can speak to the motivations that people have to help support others, to respond to suffering, and try to contribute to the success of something larger than themselves. And I came across this amazing exercise that was invented by Wayne and Cheryl Baker at Humax. They said, look, the biggest barrier to compassion, to generosity in organizations, is actually that people are afraid to ask for help because they don't want to look vulnerable. They don't want to embarrass themselves. And so they don't ask as often as they should. And then we have a lot of frustrated givers who would be perfectly happy to step up and contribute if only they knew who could benefit and how. So they created this exercise. It's called the reciprocity ring. And they said, all you do is you gather a group of people and you ask them all to make a request for something they want or need but cannot get on their own. And then you challenge everybody else in that group to try to help and respond to the needs that other people are bringing to the table. And that's the whole exercise. Everybody asks, and everybody tries to give. and you see some pretty unusual requests. Early on, we had somebody say, my dream is to see a Bengal tiger in the wild. And we're like, that's what you asked for? You could ask for anything. Why that? This guy's like, you don't understand. I was a tiger every year for Halloween as a child. I root for all the sports teams that have tiger in their name and all the universities that do, even though I've never lived in any of those places or gone to any of those schools. And I just really want to be part of a world where Bengal tigers roam free. No one in the room has ever set foot on a continent where that's possible. But one person in the room says, I might have a contact for you, and makes an introduction. And a month later, this guy is flying out for a private tour of a game preserve. Now, unfortunately, the tigers got lit. No, I'm just kidding. But never would have happened if you hadn't floated that request to a group of people with different knowledge and different networks who are willing to step up and support each other. So I thought, what a great exercise to run in my classroom. I want to get students in the habit of helping others, but I also want to get them in the habit of really asking and being comfortable putting their needs out on the table. And a few years ago, I had a student named Alex who said, I haven't really told anybody this, but my dream is to work at Six Flags Amusement Parks. I just believe riding roller coasters is nirvana, and I would love to be part of that, but strangely, Six Flags does not recruit at the Wharton School of Business. So does anyone know a way to get my foot in the door? And another student named Andrew jumps in and he says, I might have an idea for you. So Andrew does a little 5-minute favor. Great idea. Just a small way of adding value to other people's lives. A micro loan of your time, your connections, or your skills to others. And a few weeks later, Alex comes into class and I ask for an update. So what happened? And Alex says, well, you won't believe this, but I just got off the phone with the former CEO of Six Flags. I'm like, this is the greatest thing that's ever happened in my classroom. Did he get you a job? Did he open up other connections? And Alex says, even better. And he breaks out into this huge grin. And he says, I learned so much that I now know I never want to work in that industry. And I was depressed for a little while. But then I realized that Alex could now rule out that dream and go on to pursue others. And I'm proud to report that he did follow one of his other dreams and is now gainfully employed as a management consultant, who swears that one day he will fix the broken amusement park industry. But I think this is a powerful exercise, and it's something we could all run in our work, in our communities, or any part of our lives. Gather a group of people, have them all make requests. And the beauty of it is that the givers are willing to ask when everybody's expected to make a request. They still cheat. They ask on behalf of other people. And they're like, oh, I have a request for my daughter or for my friend or for my colleague. And that's not really the point of the exercise. But I suppose if you need a gateway drug to get to the hard stuff of asking for yourself, so be it. The takers also end up giving, which is sort of unusual for them because they know that all the contributions are visible. So if you do it in a small group, people volunteer to help out loud. If you do it in a large group, people will sign up on flip charts. And the takers know if they don't volunteer, everyone's going to know they're a taker. And they don't want to get caught. So we actually find that they triple their contributions during this exercise relative to what they would normally give. And the biggest effect, though, we find is on the matchers, these people who believe in quid pro quo. Because they walk away realizing that that's not an efficient way to manage a community or a team. Because the odds that I can help the same person who helped me are pretty low. Right? What works best here is I make a request and somebody helps me. And then somebody else helps that person. If we all establish this norm of generosity, we can all get more of what we want. And I thought this was such a cool exercise. And I came across this call center, AppleTree Answers, which had 97% annual turnover. If you can imagine your entire staff quitting every year and having to rehire and retrain, some of you are like, if I work with takers, that would be a good thing. But they said, what if we establish this same process? And we create an internal Make-A-Wish Foundation where every single one of our employees can make a request and then we try to help grant it. They implement this program and within 6 months, their turnover drops to 33%. And it wasn't just getting requests fulfilled. It was knowing that you worked for a company that believed in allowing you to make a request and created a forum where people could help each other and support each other. And I think if we can do that, we can move a little bit toward compassion at work. But I don't think this is without problems, because the more generous you are, the more committed you are to giving, the more you get a reputation for being helpful. And then pretty soon, no good deed goes unpunished because everybody wants something from you. We see this in healthcare a lot. It's called compassion fatigue. And sadly, the very people who are supposed to take care of us end up themselves exhausted and burned out. And then they're not able to help anymore. And pretty soon, they're just saying, you know what? I can't step up. And one of the most important things I've learned about how to overcome that has to do with how you organize your giving and helping. So there are two different strategies that we find. One is called sprinkling, where you say, look, I'm gonna do a little bit for other people every day. The other is chunking, where you say, I'm gonna pick one day and make that my day of generosity every week. Sonia Lyubomirsky and her colleagues actually randomly assign people to do one or the other. So imagine you're gonna do 5 random acts of kindness next week. If you sprinkle, you'll do one of those each day. If you chunk, you're gonna say, Thursday's my giving day, and I'm gonna do all 5 acts that day. And then she follows them. She has him do this for 10 weeks, and she follows them to see who gets happier. How many people think the sprinklers get happier? Raise your hands, please. One act of generosity every day boosts your mood, okay? How many think it's the chunkers who get happier? Okay, that looks like a minority, and the minority is actually right in this case. Only one group gets anything out of this exercise, and that's the chunkers. If you do one random act of kindness every day for other people, it does nothing whatsoever for your mood or your happiness. It might help other people, but it's useless for you. The chunkers, on the other hand, get a sustainable boost in energy that lasts for the full 10 weeks that they pick one giving day every single week. And we think that's because sprinkling is like a drop in the bucket. It doesn't feel like you've really made a difference. Whereas when you pick that one day to be helpful, you have those 5 acts add up and you're like, you know what? I had an impact today. I feel like I made a contribution. And it's also much more efficient as opposed to distracting from your other priorities. And so I think this is something we could all do. The data show just 2 hours of volunteering a week in the US and Australia is enough to boost health and even longevity. And I think if you pick one day, right, as opposed to trying to spread this out throughout your week, it's a lot easier to be compassionate without sacrificing yourself. The other thing that we've learned about compassion fatigue, which I think is really critical, I stumbled into it at a call center. And I have to say, I walked into this call center and the people there were not at all concerned about other humans. And I was a little depressed at first, but then I was walking around the call center. It was a university fundraising initiative. So they were calling alumni and trying to get them to donate their hard-earned money. This was not at all what the job was about. They were fundraising for all sorts of important initiatives. They were supporting student scholarships, faculty salaries, new buildings on campus. And I began to realize that part of the problem with these fundraising callers is they had no idea where the money they raised was going. So I thought, what if we showed them their impact? What if we connected the dots? And ran a simple experiment, just randomly assigned some of the callers to meet one scholarship student. This is at the University of Michigan, and he came in and he said, look, Michigan is in my blood, quite literally. My brother was conceived after a Michigan football game. We could not afford this out-of-state tuition, but I've always wanted to come here. And because of the work that you do, I was able to get a scholarship, and now I can attend school at the place that I've always wanted to go. And I just wanted to thank you all so much for the work that you do to make scholarships like mine possible. 5-minute interaction with one scholarship student. Month later, the average caller spiked 142% in weekly minutes on the phone and 171% in weekly money raised. Just that one person, knowing how that person benefited from their work, it completely changed the task from I'm harassing a bunch of alumni into I'm trying to do something that will serve a group of students. And I think too often we stay disconnected and distanced from the people that our actions are ultimately helping. If we can connect those dots at work, meeting the customers or clients or end users of our products, or if you have internal customers or clients, the people who actually benefit from your work inside your organization, knowing what contribution you make is a huge driver of sustaining your energy and being able to avoid burnout. And when you look at compassion fatigue, it turns out people do not burn out because they give too much. They burn out because they give without feeling like they're having an impact. And so we can overcome that by showing them, look, here's why your work matters. Here's why your contributions help others. Now, I thought those were some useful things about compassion. But I learned after a couple years that I was missing one of the most important dimensions of this. And it took me back, actually, to an article that was in the Harvard Crimson back in, about 2003. It was about Harvard's first online social network. And it was a story about how a bunch of Harvard students got into college. They were afraid they wouldn't have any friends. And so they started searching online to see who else was going to be entering their freshman class. And they found a few people and they started an email list. And then by the spring, they had over 100 people on this email list. By the time in September they arrived for college, they had connected more than an eighth of the entering class. And then they arrived on campus and they said, we all know each other face to face. We don't need this online social network. And they disbanded it. And then 5 years later, Mark Zuckerberg started Facebook in the dorm next door. Now, the co-founders of that first online social network have lived with deep regret ever since that. And I know this because I was one of those co-founders. Yeah, that's how I felt too. Thanks for that. Now, I never would have started Facebook. I don't know how to code. I wouldn't have had Mark's vision or Sheryl's business acumen. But it is really painful to look back and see the mistakes and the failures that we've faced. And it turns out in those circumstances, one of the best things that we can do is we can actually develop self-compassion. I think it's maybe the most important and most overlooked form of compassion. Not showing kindness toward others who are suffering, but kindness toward ourselves when we are suffering. And this happens in all kinds of situations, right? It's relevant to failures, it's relevant to mistakes and accidents, and all kinds of embarrassing, cringeworthy, awkward moments that we might experience. And I think that we're pretty bad at doing this overall. And especially for those of you who are fans of mindfulness, you might be especially bad at it. Because if you're into mindfulness, it's all about living in the moment. But when you've just failed, the moment sucks. There is nowhere you want to be, anywhere near that moment, right? You'd rather be in the past or in the future, definitely not now, because who wants to confront all those feelings of inadequacy and guilt and shame and incompetence? Self-compassion is about trying to gain distance from that moment by offering yourself the same kindness that you would give to a friend who is suffering or struggling. Mark Leary and his colleagues did this really cool experiment where they had people think about a big failure that they'd experienced, where they forgot their lines in a school play, or they bombed a test, or they didn't make the soccer team. And then some of them were randomly assigned to think positive and write about their strengths and affirm their self-esteem. Others were randomly assigned to try to find self-compassion by writing a letter to themselves, showing themselves the same kindness and understanding that they would normally give to a friend. And that second group, on average, was 40% happier and 24% less angry after writing that letter, showing themselves compassion. And I think this is something we could all do, right? It's the first thing that I started doing after I learned about this research was to write about all the reasons I should forgive myself for not starting Facebook. And it's become a really useful step throughout various realms in my professional life. And part of the reason for that is I became a professor and I was terrified of public speaking, absolutely frightened of it. And so I thought, I need some practice. So what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna volunteer to give guest lectures for other people's classes. And that way I won't have a whole semester to build relationships. I'm just getting evaluated on how I do on stage. So I went and gave some guest lectures and I handed out feedback forms afterward and said, tell me what I can, you know, do to get better and also, you know, what strengths I should build on. And the comments were brutal. I will never forget the one student who wrote, you are so nervous that you're causing me to physically shake in my seat. Only much later did I realize that this would have been really useful in my magician days. I was like, wow, cool. I can transfer my emotions across a room. This is powerful. But that was extremely uncomfortable to go through. And the thing that I learned that was so relevant to self-compassion there was I can't control the evaluation that I've gotten after I've given a speech or taught a class, right? That's already happened. And that's true anytime you failed or screwed up or run into any kind of difficulty. What you can control is your response to that failure or that adversity. And so what's often recommended is to give yourself a second score, where you say, look, I might have gotten a C minus for this presentation, but I can still get an A plus for how I deal with the feedback from that presentation. So I said, look, I wanna try to improve my second score. And even if I'm not gonna be good at this task, I'm gonna be good at taking critical feedback. And so I just kept asking after every single lecture that I gave, how could I improve? What's the one thing I could do to get better? And I started to get more and more comfortable in the classroom. And then I got invited to teach a group of colonels and generals in the US Air Force. And this was a bad idea in retrospect, because I walked in there and I basically had this staring back at me. The average person in the room was about 50. They were twice my age. They had hundreds and hundreds of hours of flying experience. They were managing multi-billion dollar budgets. I was a 25-year-old with a brand new PhD, and I was supposed to tell them how to lead. So I felt like what I had to do was I had to establish credibility, and I walked in there and started discussing my credentials. And they looked like they were about to shoot me. And afterward, the feedback forms were even harsher than the ones that I'd gotten from undergraduates. One of the colonels wrote, there was more knowledge in the audience than on the podium. I was like, yeah, that's true. Thank you. And then another one wrote, I gained nothing from this session, but I trust the instructor gained useful insight. Like a dagger to the heart. And so I said, okay, second score. How am I going to take this feedback well? Unfortunately, I had committed to give another session for another group of Air Force colonels a week later. So I didn't have time to reboot my 4 hours of content. All I could do was change the way that I established a connection with them at the start of the session. And I said, all right, before I had tried to lead with competence, now I'm going to try to lead with humility and let them know that I don't actually know what I'm doing here, and we're going to try to learn together. So I walked in, and I said, look, I know what you all are thinking right now. What could I possibly learn from a professor who's 12 years old? And it was just dead silent. The only sound that I could hear was my racing heartbeat. And then after what felt like an eternity, one of the colonels piped in and he was like, that's ridiculous. I'm pretty sure you're 13. And it completely broke the ice. I delivered a near carbon copy of the same class I had taught before, but the evaluations were completely different. They said things like, although junior in experience, the professor dealt with the material in an interesting way. And we're gonna manage more and more millennials now, and it's kind of cool to learn from someone who almost is one. It was a great lesson for me that a big part of self-compassion is being willing to put our weaknesses out there, right? Being willing to be vulnerable and let other people see that we're human and imperfect. That's the only way we learn. It's the only way we get better, is to say, look, I am a work in progress. And to do that, we have to be willing to forgive ourselves for the mistakes and the stumbles.
Want to experience the magic of Dreamforce but don't have a full conference pass? We are thrilled to invite you to register for a free Expo Plus pass for access to select events on Thursday and Friday at Dreamforce. Head over to dreamforce.com/free to register now. With the free pass, you'll learn about the latest innovations at select product and industry keynotes, test drive thousands of solutions, access hundreds of partners in the Customer Success Expo, and network with fellow trailblazers. Again, register at dreamforce.com/free and we'll see you in just a few days. Self-compassion comes in many forms. Standing up and asking for feedback is another way to have others to support your own development and better yourself. Grant also touches on the daughter effect, which shows a common pitfall in compassion. Let's dive back in into Adam Grant's talk from last year's Dreamforce, all about compassion in action.
I'm just stunned by how the floodgates open and how I hear suggestions for improvement, constructive criticism, complaints that I never got before. And I think there's something really powerful about standing up and saying, look, here are some of the most unpleasant things that I've heard about myself. And look, I'm able to take it, right? I'm willing to listen to it. And I think it's a great way to get other people to help you learn, which is ultimately the best path to self-compassion, is to get other people to support you in your own development. And it feels a lot like having a group of people who are formally evaluating you now turning into your coaches. Right? Those of you who ever played sports or did any kind of performance art, you were never threatened by negative feedback from your coach because your coach was there to help you. That was the whole purpose of having a coach. And I think that most of the people that we work with, if we could view them that way, that their sole goal is to develop us and try to make us more successful, then it's a lot easier to have compassion for ourselves when we do fall short of our expectations or short of our targets or short of other people's expectations for that matter. And I think self-compassion is really critical because one of the things that happens is if you lack it, then you end up just beating yourself up over and over again when you've struggled or suffered, as opposed to having concern for other people, as opposed to being able to help others and express compassion for others. And I think if we don't model and develop compassion for ourselves, it's really difficult then to show the kind of concern for others that we want to. Now, the last theme that I want to highlight is something that was not on my radar until far, far too recently, which is about 9 years ago, I had my first child, and she was a daughter. And all of a sudden, I became just extremely attuned to all the inequality that women face in the world. And I think all of you know all the data that have come out. And I don't need to go through all the points, but what I want to say is, it's amazing how little change we are willing to tolerate and willing to accept. Those of you who saw the Lean In McKinsey report last month showing that half of men and a third of women thought that if you had 10% of your executives as women, that was enough. I don't know about you, but from my perspective, that is not enough. And I think the sad reality is that there are a lot of people who lack compassion when we look at the kinds of gender biases that we see in the world. And I'm embarrassed that I spent too many years thinking that there weren't a lot of gender differences. When I started studying givers, takers, and matchers, I didn't even bother to look at differences between men and women. I said, look, you know what? We're in the 21st century. We're at a point, finally, where people are being evaluated for their contributions, not based on their gender. And then Sheryl Sandberg started grilling me on gender differences in my data, and I couldn't answer the questions. So I spent a whole flight across the country, reanalyzing a decade of my data, and I was horrified by what I found. I found that men and women, when men helped other people, they got rewarded for it and celebrated. People are like, wow, I never would have expected a man to care about another human being. I must now shower him with praise and rewards. When women helped, it was just taken for granted. It was like, she's caring, she's communal, she wants to help. And women had to do a lot more helping than men to get the same performance evaluations, even if they were equally excellent at their jobs. I also found that when men spoke up, they got a pat on the back for it. When women had ideas and suggestions, they were either barely heard or they were judged as too aggressive. And there was this really unfortunate double bind. And I started thinking about what we could do to open our eyes, all of our eyes, because we all have biases, to the fact that we're still not at a place where we're anywhere near equality of opportunity. And I came across this staggering evidence, which says one of the most powerful things that can happen to a man is having a daughter. And I was like, yes, I've experienced this. It turns out, if you look at a study of 10,000 Danish CEOs, if their firstborn child is a daughter, they will pay their employees more generously, especially female employees. If you look at legislators in America and average male voters in the UK, you will see that those with daughters are more likely to vote in support of reproductive rights. And by the way, those of you who are like, wait a minute, correlation isn't causation? Actually, it is in this case, because there's no way that your voting patterns can cause you to have a daughter instead of a son. Or cause your pay decisions, right? The gender of your firstborn child is pretty much randomly assigned. Venture capital partners, those of you in Silicon Valley will know, there's some recent evidence that if venture capital partners have daughters, they are more likely to have gender diversity in their partnership, represented at the highest levels of their firm. And if every single venture capitalist had a daughter instead of a son, on average, they would have 10% higher chances of a successful IPO that produces positive returns. So I thought this was great news. And I have to tell you, after reflecting on this for a few years, I think this is incredibly sad. I think this is a severe failure of empathy and compassion. Why do we have to wait to have a daughter in order to care about women? And I will tell you that I am embarrassed that it took having two daughters for me to wake up to this issue. As opposed to saying, I have a mother, I have a sister, I have lots of female friends and aunts and cousins. It shouldn't be until we have a female infant that we're caring for that we start to care about these issues. And I think the compassion, part of compassion is recognizing when other people are facing disadvantage, when they are not given the same opportunities that we are, that we have to step up and do something about it. And I want to speak in particular to the white men in this room. To say that if you look at the data, Dave Heckman and his colleagues have studied this, and they found that when women and minorities advocate for diversity, they get penalized for it. It's seen as self-serving, like they're trying to advantage their own group. Whereas when white men advocate for diversity, they actually get rewarded for it. They're seen as good guys who are trying to do the right thing. And I think if there's one place to use white male privilege, it might be in advocating for people who are neither white or neither male. So when you think about compassion, I think it's worth thinking about how you can get people to ask for help more often and know that will bring out the compassion in others. It's worth thinking about how you can make sure that you manage the costs of helping others so that your own compassion does not come at your expense and so that you sustain your energy to be able to support others. Giving compassion to yourself, not just to other people, and also to those who are less fortunate than you. I think if we had a world where more people did that, we would live in a slightly less awful world than we do right now. And I hope you all will help me create that world. Thank you.
This podcast is brought to you by Plevo, Clevo is a cloud API platform and a global carrier services provider. Learn more at www.clevo.com. Thank you so much for joining us for this amazing season of Blazing Trails. We've had a blast with you, discovering and listening to some of the most thought-provoking and insightful conversations from Salesforce events around the world. We are so excited to see all of you at Dreamforce in just a few days. Be sure to join the conversation online with hashtag DF18 and to follow us across social media at Dreamforce. Be sure to subscribe on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts and keep up with exclusive content from trailblazers around the world. We'll see you in 2019 for season 3 of Blazing Trails.